Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today is one that's been on our mind ever since we started Mountain State Mysteries. In the summer of 1977, Sister Roberta Elam was enjoying a peaceful afternoon on the grounds of her convent in West Virginia. Until her life was tragically cut short, she was found murdered, a crime that shocked both the religious community and the nation. Was this a random act of violence, or did someone closer to Sister Robin have a dark secret? This is a case of Sister Roberta Elam. Roberta Ann Elam was born on August 23, 1950, in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was the oldest of four children, two boys and two girls. Her brother Chris Elam described Robin as, quote, the leader of the pack, as it were, as the oldest sibling, and we all looked up to her. Robin was a rebel. She was one of these people who absolutely told everyone what she thought. She was extremely direct, very opinionated. She was pretty much a normal teenager, and unbeknownst to any of us, really, Robin became very intrigued with the idea of living in a religious community. Her deal, if you want to call it that, was just about social justice, helping others, making a difference. She wanted to become a priest. She thought that a woman not being allowed to become a priest was absolutely ludicrous. If she had lived, she would have been an activist. Women's empowerment, she would have been right there, end quote.
Growing up, her father worked for ITT and moved the family from Minnesota to Illinois before settling down in Allendale, New Jersey. Roberta loved to write poetry and enjoyed hiking and jogging. She played on the basketball team in high school. After she graduated high school, she attended Maryland College, where she received a bachelor's in arts and theology. After that, she went on to graduate from Fordham University in New York, where she received her master's degree in theology.
In 1975, Roberta moved back in with her parents in New Jersey for a short time. When Roberta announced that she wanted to become a nun, I don't want to say it shocked them. I mean, she did want to become a priest. It may have just took them a little bit to understand why.
Why's that?
From what I can tell, growing up, Roberta didn't really have any signs that she wanted to become a nun. I mean, she seemed like the typical teenager. She drove an orange Fiat sports convertible, dated boys, did all of the normal teenage girl things.
I mean, everything like the quote that her brother just said, it literally makes you wonder.
Yeah.
What made her change her mind?
Honestly, I have no idea. I tried to dig for it in everything that's online, but I couldn't find anything. In August of 1976, Roberta came to West Virginia, where she started to work with the Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston by traveling the state and teaching religious education classes. And here's a fun little fact. She actually went by where we're recording right now. Yeah, she taught a class in Wyoming County. Merlin Campbell of Mullen said, quote, I knew her as a beautiful human being, giving unselfishly of herself in the service of God, end quote. Needless to say, the people who took her classes remembered her fondly.
Honestly, like what everybody has been saying about her and everything, she seems like the type that could make friends anywhere she went.
Oh, 100%. It was around that time she became known as Sister Robin.
So, I know whenever they go in to become a nun, they take on a new name. But it kind of makes you wonder why she chose Robin.
You know, that I'm not too sure. All I know is that the changing of names is like a religious practice. And it's, I guess the name they pick is kind of like to symbolize their new commitment to God. I'm honestly not too sure why she did pick Robin.
It just, honestly, it just makes you kind of wonder a little bit.
Which, I mean, it could also be short for, like, Roberta.
Only thing I know is I love the name Robin.
Same.
It's just something about it.
Yeah. In June of 1977, Robin moved into the mother house at St. Joseph's Convent, where she would start an 8-day silent retreat.
I mean, obviously, I'm going to say neither one of us truly know what it is to become a nun.
No.
So, it makes me kind of wonder, what exactly are the 8 days of silence for?
I don't know. Well, for prayer and compilation, but I do know me and you could not be silent for 8 days.
God, no. I mean, we're silent maybe 45 minutes in a car ride.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't even last, like, sleeping.
One thing we do want to point out is during the research, we did hear that Robin asked another one of the girls in the retreat, what would you think if I left? Like, which to me seems like a very normal thing. I mean, you're going through this huge change in life. And in all honesty, you had that thought going in your mind, am I really cut out for this? Is this the right thing for me to do?
Yeah, and I mean, becoming a nun, you were literally putting yourself in basically a life of poverty in a way. So, I mean, I can see where she or anyone who was going into it would question every single bit of it. Because, I mean, it's a huge life change. So, I get it. So, I feel like everyone who goes into that or, you know, being a monk, like any religious thing, you definitely do have that thought. Probably more than once.
Absolutely.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe,
and watch for deer.
On June 13th, 1977, Sister Robin woke up and went on her morning jog. After she met briefly with either her director and spiritual advisor, around 10:30 a.m., she stopped by to grab a snack, which ended up just being an apple. She left the kitchen and went to a quiet area near the mother house to meditate and contemplate taking her final vows. She walked to a secluded bench overlooking the Spiegel golf course. As she sat on the bench in meditation, Sister Robin had no idea that there was danger approaching from behind her. Around 1:50 p.m., a caretaker discovered Roberta's lifeless body on a slope not far from the bench. It's believed that she had been attacked from behind and pulled backwards over the bench.
Pretty much like she was caught completely off guard.
Yeah, like the killer carried her 30 feet from where she was. She was raped and strangled. She had been wearing street clothes, her blouse and bra had been pulled up, and her pants and underwear had been pulled down.
You would think where it's so close by a golf course,
you would think there would be somebody who had to witness that, like one of the golfers or something.
I mean, you would think that, but the spot where she was, like, she wouldn't have been in view of either the convent or the golf course.
The Ojai County Sheriff's Department arrived to the scene and took the body to the Willing Hospital for an autopsy. It was believed that Robin had been attacked from behind and dragged to the spot some 30 to 50 yards away. This was known not only by the location of the body when she was discovered, but also notable by disturbances in the grass near the tree line.
They called bloodhounds to the scene in an attempt to aid in the recovery of any potential evidence. Sadly, no results came from this. In fact, the scene itself was kind of void of any evidence at all.
What all did they find there?
Just her body, possessions, and the overturned bench. There's, in all honesty, kind of something interesting about the property that I keep thinking about.
What's that?
So, with the property, you think that there would be a fence or something kind of like separating it where it's a mother house. There isn't. So, like, if you would know it, like it's behind the line of trees, you would know where the mother house is. You would know the property, all of that.
Just speculating. Someone would have known that it was there for it to be that easily accessible.
Pretty much. Like, if you look at a map, you can gain entry just by going through the trees. If you look at the map, you can see that you can gain entry by traveling Pogue Run Road and turn onto Oglesby Drive. In 1977, Pogue Run Road was known as a lover's lane with areas that you could pull off and park. And the spot Sister Robin was in was a quiet spot that nuns would typically go to. Which, actually, some of the nuns at the mother house contemplated going up there the day she was murdered.
The location she was at, was it concealed by trees all the way around?
Yeah, like, there is no way anyone could have seen anything. It's, I guess, kind of like our field here. Like, you know it's here, you know it's big. Most of the people don't know it's here. Like, you would have to go on Google Maps and see it. But once you're in here, you see what it is. You just can't see it from the road because of the trees. After this, the state police issued a public appeal for help, stating they had been unable to develop any suspects or leads in the case. The autopsy revealed that Robin had been raped and that a tampon was still present at the time of her murder. They also found bruising on her neck, throat, and legs. But she had zero defense wounds.
Even though they found all this out in the autopsy, what was her official cause of death?
It was determined that it had been manual strangulation. They estimated that the time of her death happened between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. on June 13th. Even though it was initially believed that Robin was attacked from behind, the positioning of the bruising around the neck showed that she was more than likely assaulted from the front. So it kind of seemed to police that Roberta knew her murderer. Law enforcement was quick to interview the nuns at Mount St. Joseph, as well as golfers who were playing on the golf course that day, which the nuns did report hearing commotion shortly after Robin left the kitchen. The voices were described as high-pitched. The nuns just assumed that, you know, maybe it was golfers making a hole-in-one on the golf course, but they just shrugged it off.
Essentially, with the high-pitched screams, they were hearing Robin's attack happening.
Potentially.
Did they have a lead on anyone?
Kinda. Police were actually looking for a vehicle seen in the area and a suspect. The description was a mid-1960s Chevrolet Impala with religious bumper stickers, and I want to say maybe a coal miner sticker. The car was seen near Oglesby Park on the day Robin was found. The driver was described as white, dark-haired male between 30 to 40 years old, and witnesses recalled the car either being a light blue or a gray. In court, I have the complete sketch of the guy printed off. What do you think?
In all honesty, he's someone who doesn't look like he's wrapped
too tight.
Yeah.
Does that make any type of sense?
Yeah, like I don't know. He just seems like one of those that if you would see him on the street, maybe you would just like pay a lot of attention to and not acknowledge or at like you're crossing the street.
But in all honesty, though, from you know how much I love vintage stuff.
Mm-hmm. He looks like a typical person from the 70s.
Absolutely, 100% he does.
Yeah, like my dad had that haircut.
However, there is something with his eyes. Mm-hmm. Just something there that's just showing like, I don't know, maybe a screw's loose or something.
Yeah.
Something of that nature. And it also, with just things about what's going on here, it had to be someone who knew Robin's routine.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had to study this. And someone had to know that property inside and out to know, okay, this is where the nuns go to pray. This is where they meditate. This is where they reflect. Things of that nature. Like, you would have to know exactly where things were because just randomly coming across it and Robin's there and then you attack, you rape and things of that nature. To me, this is somebody I feel possibly could be stalking her and I mean, things of that nature, because I feel like sometimes like some of the murderers and stuff like that or things of that nature, like I feel a lot of them's not random attacks. They're plotted out. They know their victims' routines. They know it always. Don't ever do your routine same every day. Mix it up. Words of wisdom. But it just, you know, I feel that this had to be somebody who knew her routine. Okay, well, she's going for a run. Okay, she goes for a run every day. We're going to say at 8:30 in the morning or something. Or whatever, because it had to be enough for her to be able to get a run in. She would have to come back, take a shower, get redressed, and then do all that. And it has to be like a same routine pattern to where they knew where she was going to be at during that time frame.
And in all honesty, this wasn't the only guy that police knew about. The nuns actually told them about another guy. It was a member of an Atlanta-based salvage crew that was removing cables from the convent.
Did they know what the nuns said?
Well, the nuns told police that this guy and Sister Robin had some words because he made comments about her and some of the other nuns. In a lot of reports, it said that they don't know what Sister Robin said, but you know me, I couldn't just leave it at that. Although I couldn't find what she actually said, I do know she discussed the incident during dinner that evening, telling them, quote, "It was awful the way they talked about us," end quote, and that the man had a, quote, "filthy mouth," end quote.
Is there anything known of what he said to her?
All I know is that he said something that no one should honestly say about women, especially a nun. So Robert Flanagan, who was a caretaker at the time, not the one who found Robin, but he said, quote, "He made a real dirty crack about the nuns," end quote.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
final person that was on police radars for Sister Robin's murder was John Shoplack, who was a willing native, which I don't think you'll ever guess what brought him onto the radar for Sister Robin's murder.
Possible DNA?
No. Actually, his ex-girlfriend, who he broke up with. Actually, his ex-girlfriend, who had broken up with him prior to the murder, like within a month, said that, you know, John had an awful temper and that he choked her once.
Did he choke her and then they broke up? Or what exactly was the motive that led her to go to the police?
Honestly, I have no idea. I know that it was kind of well known in the area that John had a hatred for Catholics and had two prior rape convictions under his belt. Like, this was the type of man who would cut off his grandmother's finger to steal a ring.
Do you care to repeat that?
He was the type of guy who would cut off his grandmother's finger to steal a ring.
What type of human being do you have to be?
I honestly don't know. But that's literally all that I could find on that, is that he cut off her finger to steal a ring.
Well, that's something.
Yeah. And I do have to say, his ex-girlfriend isn't really the only one that came forward. A former friend of John's came forward as well. In his statement, he claims that John confessed to him that he attacked and murdered the nun. The man said John had stated that he approached her from behind and used his belt to strangle her. He also mentioned that the nun was, quote, either a virgin or coming off the rag because he had blood on him, end quote. And let me just say that Sister Robin was actually on her period, but it wasn't released as like public knowledge at the time.
With the blood that was on John, did they do any type of testing or anything?
They did, and he was cleared of any involvement of the crime. But I do want to say, like, with advances in technology, I wish they could test something right now, because at the time, it was kind of during the time where military records were kind of like funky and iffy. So they think that maybe his blood type that was on the record and his didn't match up at the time of the investigation.
Ooh, you want to know something?
What?
I want to say, I believe it was sometime, I forget when it was, but in St. Louis is where they kept all the records, military records. There was a huge fire. Records got destroyed. So, you know, it's a good possibility that a murderer got away.
Oh, 100%. In October of 1977, another suspect ended up on the list for police. Henry Edgar Beck was considered as a possible subject for what reason? TBD. I'm really not sure. All I know is that he was cleared by jail records because he was being held in connection with two other sexual cases.
In October of 2005, believing advances in DNA technology could now solve the case, DNA evidence from the crime scene was submitted to the West Virginia State Forensics Laboratory. And the investigation was reinvestigated. New leads were followed up on as far as San Francisco in relation to Sister Robin's murder. Investigators obtained DNA samples and eliminated 23 people, some now dead, whose names haven't been released. But I do know that they were provided by tipsters. And they also developed new leads and suspects they have yet to share with the public. In August of 2019, John Shoplack died. He was hospitalized, and authorities are hopeful that testing with DNA can now be done.
So, you know me, there's kind of one theory I've left out.
What theory?
It was believed that Sister Robin may have actually been going to meet a guy the day she was murdered.
Is there any proof?
No. Sister Kathleen Duncan was actually asked about this and if she thought Sister Robin might have had a secret journal. And Court, do you want to read what she said?
This is about the second journal. Quote, Not that I know of. My understanding is that any of that is what the police has all this time, end quote. So she's basically saying that there was only one journal that the police had, and she's never known about a second one.
Pretty much. You want to read what she thought on Sister Robin meeting with the guy?
Quote, let me just say, if she did, first of all, she had just gone into retreat, and there were about six other people in the retreat. Two of them, I know, told me they too had contemplated going up on the hill, because that's what we did. We walked all over these grounds. So if she was planning some sort of meeting with a man, it would have been a little odd. I mean, it would have been like, first of all, totally public. And anyone else could have came upon it. 42 years ago, lots of people would have been up there, end quote. In an episode of the DNA of Murder with Paul Holes, he met with Laura Petler, a forensic criminologist, who talked about John Shoplack. She said, quote, in the crime scene, we don't see a lot of anger. We see a lot of power. We see Robin overpowered by someone, incapacitated, strangled. It definitely is a power-based crime, and he's a power-assertive offender. He has an ex-girlfriend who gave a statement that she said he was a violent person. She dated him for 3 months. They broke up in May, and they have Robin killed on June 13, 1977. He also put something around her throat to keep her quiet. And that's a significant similarity between what we know about Robin's murder, because she was also incapacitated to be quiet, end quote.
As of right now, the case of Sister Roberta Elam is still open. It's been 48 years since the senseless murder of Sister Roberta Elam. She would have been 75 years old today.
If you or anyone you know has any information on the murder of Sister Roberta Elam, please contact the Willing Detachment of the West Virginia State Police at 304-238-1100.
We'll be back next week with a brand new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.